when we stand here at the front, we've been praying, I think, for guidance as to what we speak about. And I felt strongly that God was wanting me to speak about Jacob and Joseph. Jacob, he was quite a character, a real con man, a deceiver, a schemer, a twister, a sharp dealer, born grasping his twin brother's heel. His twin brother, of course, being Esau. Jacob, a quiet man, his mother's favorite. Esau, loved by dad. Jacob stayed in the nomadic tents. He was with the family. Esau was an outdoor man, a skillful hunter. And under the ancient law of primogeniture, the younger would serve the older. The firstborn would also receive a double share of the father's property. So Esau was the senior by seconds, maybe. But Jacob was there, grasping his heel. We are told in chapter 25 of Genesis that Esau was out hunting. Hunting out in the wilds, came back. He was starving. He had nothing to eat all day. He was absolutely starving. And here is Jacob in the nomadic tent, stirring this nice pot of stew. The aroma was fantastic. And Esau says, "Oh, come on, give me some of that stew. I am starving." And Jacob, the schemer, says, yeah, but you sell me your birthright. You're the senior. Come on, sell me your birthright. Oh, come on. Yes, do it. I'm really starving, Esau says. Well, swear to me that you'll sell me your birthright. And Esau, in that impetuous moment, swears that he will give Jacob his birthright. Now, we are told that a word verbally spoken and sworn about in those days was binding by law. It was something he did. It had legal significance. And so in that impulsive moment, Esau trades away his birthright to Jacob. Esau despised his birthright. In chapter 27, we read again of Rebekah, the mother, saying, "You know, your dad is not well. He's got very poor eyesight. Esau is out there. He's hunting for something nice for your dad. And when he comes back, Dad, I've heard him say, is going to give him his special blessing. His special blessing. Listen, son, Jacob, I want you to pretend that you are Esau." Esau was a hairy man. They killed a couple of goats. They put the skin on his arms and the back of his neck. He dressed in his clothes and he served his dad. "Is that you, son?" "Yes, Dad, this is Esau." "Are you sure?" And he strokes the back of his neck and "Okay, son, I give you my blessing." And there in that moment, we are told that Isaac gave Jacob his blessing. Jacob, the schemer, the deceiver. And when Esau comes back, he says, "Dad, I've got this meal for you." "Who is that?" "But I've given you my..." "No, Dad, it wasn't me. It was Jacob. You gave your blessing, your legally binding blessing to Jacob and not to Esau." We are told that Esau was so upset that Jacob not only had stolen his birthright, but had indeed compounded that by getting his father's blessing, that he said, "I'm going to kill him." And Rebekah, the mother, says, "Listen, Jacob, flee for your life. Go to your uncle Laban. Spend time there until Esau's hatred, his desire to kill, has dissolved." He goes to Laban. And we are told that he spends time with Laban. He goes all the way through Paddan Aram. Interesting. We are told that Paddan Aram is the plain of Aram. Not down the road there, but the plain of Aram. And he breaks his journey at a place called Bethel. Now here is the schemer. Here is the deceiver. He puts a stone for a pillow and he lies there, and during the night he has a dream. And God is speaking to him in that dream, and he says, I am the Lord God of your father Abraham, the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All people on the earth will be blessed through you and to your offspring. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring you back again to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised. Here is God blessing the schemer, the deceiver, the con man. I find that difficult because I think Esau got a raw deal. Esau, in his impetuosity, steals the birthright, or trades his birthright. And I realize that God can use anybody. He hardened Pharaoh's heart. He prompts the Persian king Artaxerxes to grant Nehemiah relief, release to go and build the walls of Jerusalem. He prompts Cyrus, king of Persia, to allow Ezra to go and rebuild the temple. These are pagan kings. He uses Rahab the prostitute to conceal the Israelite spies before the Battle of Jericho. He uses King Darius in the book of Ezra for the people to return to the reconstructed city. God uses his sovereign will as he will. And sometimes we think, but that's unjust. Poor Esau, what happened to him? We are told that Isaac was filled with great regret. And he says, my son, I have already blessed Jacob. I cannot withdraw that blessing because it has legal and eternal power. And this is the blessing he gave to Esau. Your dwelling will be away from the earth's riches, away from the dew of heaven above. You will live by the sword, and you will serve your brother. And when you grow restless, you will throw this yoke off from your neck. That wasn't much of a blessing, but that's what Esau got from Isaac. We are also told that Esau made some bad choices. He married Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and also Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. The wives were a source of grief to Isaac and Rebekah. Interesting. Maybe there was something different about Esau that we don't realize. Impetuous, made wrong choices in whom he had married. Rebekah says, don't you make that mistake, Jacob. When you go to your uncle Laban, make sure you get a wife from your own tribe. Don't get a Hittite wife, a Canaanite wife from pagan tribes. Make sure you marry within your own your own tribe. Jacob goes to his uncle Laban. He sees Rachel. He fancies her. What do you want for your work here? Laban says, I want the hand of your daughter, Rachel. I will work 7 years for the hand of Rachel. He works for 7 years, and in a deception, he finds that he has got Leah instead. He works for another 7 years for Rachel, and eventually wins her hand. He doesn't leave Laban, but he continues there as the farmer, as the shepherd. And we are told that by God's grace and his will, he enhances his prosperity by getting the sheep that are speckled or streaked, Jacob's sheep. And soon he has got a lot of these sheep, much more so than his brother Laban and his uncle Laban. And Laban becomes jealous. Goodness me, This young guy, Jacob, I brought him on to look after my sheep. The agreement was that he would take the speckled sheep, and I thought there was very few of these. It was almost something that was wrong with them to have speckled or fleece. And yet here they are. He's got an amazing amount of these, and I've only got a small number of the proper clean sheep. He becomes jealous, and eventually Jacob has to leave. I can't stay here with Uncle Laban. I know his attitude has changed. I know he's getting upset that I have seen prosperity. God has blessed me with these big flocks of streaked spotted sheep. I must go. And he returns. He returns back towards his homeland. He crosses the brook Jabbok, and there he has an encounter with God. This is an interesting bit. He has an encounter with God, who wrestled with him till dawn. And in at that time, he says, "You have prevailed against this figure representing God. Now let me go. I will not let you go until you bless me." And that figure, that personification of God, says, "You are called Jacob, but from now on you will be called Israel." When you're a young family, do you remember the way you used to wrestle with them on the floor, dads particularly? I remember taking my boys and throwing them across the room onto the settee. They loved it. Or wrestling with them on the floor, pretending to sit on them. Of course I could overcome them. But why were you doing that? It was to restore an intimacy. It was the family. You were getting to know them. They were loving this. Dad wrestling with them, playing with them, throwing them up in the air, tickling them. It was something that brought you closer together. And here was Jacob wrestling with this God, the Creator, the personification of God. Was God able to overcome? Of course he was. Of course he could have overcome Jacob. It was almost as if he was saying, "Jacob, I'm getting to know you in a new way. I want the intimacy of contact with you. I want you to know that I have power to overcome, but I am becoming intimate with you. I'm knowing you in a new way." And he says, "Listen, I want to bless you. Your name is Jacob. You have seen me in a new light. You have seen me as father and child. You've seen me wanting to become close to you. You are Jacob, you are now Israel. I'm going to give you a new identity because you've come close in that intimacy of bond. And I want you to know that you were Jacob. You are now Israel, prince of a new nation, leader of a new nation. But I want you to know that." And he has that relationship with God through that wrestling. I wonder how we feel when we wrestle with God. Have we ever wrestled with God? Have you ever poured out your heart and said, "Lord, I really am suffering at the moment. I want you to come close to me because I don't like what's happening. I am wrestling with you. I want to know what you're saying. I want to read your word. I want you to pour out your Holy Spirit and to give me that intensity of feeling to know that you are with me and directing me in this predicament I'm in," whatever that is. Sometimes we need to wrestle with God to find out, "It's all right, I've got you, and I'm going to lead you to a solution or to my plan for your future." It's interesting that division between Esau and Jacob became such that Esau set up his kingdom in Edom, southeast in the land of Israel, around the city of Petra. Some of us have been to Petra, but around that area, that's where the Edomites settled down. And when the children of Israel, when it came to release from Egypt and going to the promised land, the Edomites still, their forebears still had resentment against the Jacob and Esau mismatch. and they would not allow them to travel through the land of Edom. You're not coming through here. You are not coming through here. You can go round another way to the promised land. And that still was there after all these years. We come to the place where Jacob and Rachel had a son. The son's name was Joseph. The other wife, Leah, through Laban's family, had 10 sons. Rachel had 2 sons, Joseph and Benjamin. Jacob was not a good parent because he showed favoritism. It got to the stage when Joseph was out with the brothers, he brought back a bad report. Dad, you wouldn't believe it, but they let the predators, the mountain lions, come in. They didn't look after the sheep. They weren't looking after them when they were giving birth. They were neglecting. He brought back a bad report. And we are told that Jacob, despite that, made him a favorite. He gave him a coat of many colors. He showed him favoritism. He would stay around the tents when the brothers were out and about in the hills, sleeping under the stars. He would be swanning around, looking, chatting to the servants. And then one day Jacob said, "Go, I want you to take these gifts, these provisions to your brothers and bring me back a report how they're doing looking after the sheep." Joseph was set out. But when he got there, he said to the brothers, "Listen, I have a dream. I've had 2 dreams, in fact. I dreamt the sheaves in the field were standing up, and my sheave was in the center, and all your sheaves were bowing down. And I remember another dream I had." These are real dreams, listen. "The sun, moon, and stars are all bowing down to my star." Gosh, the brothers hated him. "Who is this guy with his fancy jacket swanning around here, taking reports back to Dad?" They hated him. And one day when he was going out with provisions to the brothers, "Here's the dreamer coming. Let's get him. Let's kill him." And one of them said, "No." Reuben said, "No, don't kill him. Don't put blood in our hands." And when they got him, they tore his throat coat off and they put him into a dried up well. And there he sat in his underpants thinking, "What's happening? I thought I was the favorite and here I am in the mud." And they tore the coat, they killed the goat, and they said, "Well, bring this back to Dad and tell him that the mountain lion got him, a wild animal got him." And here is Joseph lying or sitting in the dried up well. "Look, here are the Ishmaelites coming. They've got a train of camels. Let's get rid of the guy. We'll sell him. 20 pieces of silver is a standard rate. Sell him to the Ishmaelites. Get rid of him." And they haul him up. And he's tied at the back of the camel, and here he's walking along all the way into Egypt. What bewilderment. How did I get into this mess? I thought Dad was going to look after me. I thought I was the favorite. And here I am, on the way to a fate I do not know what. And of course, when he gets to Egypt, what happens? He's in the slave market, prodded, looked at his teeth, examine him, people walking around, and somebody buys him. We don't know for how much for, but he happens to be the commander of the jail, Potiphar. And he goes to Potiphar's household, and you know the story as well as I do. But for a start, he begins to realize he's in a foreign land. He has to pick up the language. He has to dress appropriately. For the very first time in his life, he's probably under a discipline he did not know before. He's got to do this and do that. Now, get up in the morning. You're going to serve this household. He becomes aware of the Egyptian culture. He becomes aware that he's in a new situation altogether. We are told in the Bible that he actually prospers. God has his hand on this guy. Yes, rejected by his family, sold as a slave, now serving in Potiphar's household, God was still interested in him because the household prospers. And Potiphar says, how are things going? And the other servants, oh great, you know, this guy Joseph's been doing this and that. He's been organizing it, and soon he's in charge of Potiphar's household. He's doing very well. And the thing is, he becomes more aware of God as his Lord. I wonder how many of us have had situations where we think, I'm in a mess here, I just don't understand what's going on. Is God still with me? Yeah. That experience began to mature that reckless 17-year-old teenager who threw away discretion and spoke about his dreams almost as boasting. Ha, my seed stood up, yours were all bowing down. He encouraged almost bitterness and a division in the family. But suddenly he is learning to mature. A Jew, 13-year-old boy, celebrates Bar Mitzvah. He becomes an adult at the age of 13. He is beginning to take responsibility. In ancient Greece, between 7 and 18, boys had their hair cut, which was offered to the gods as a burnt sacrifice, and they become eligible for 2 years military service. In ancient Rome, between 14 and 17, the boys celebrated a festival called Libertalia. They took off the toga that was edged with purple, and they put on the plain toga of the adult. They were now taking legal responsibility. Joseph began to mature as an adult. What about your family? My mum used to say, when you're 21, you get the key of the door. That was 50 years ago, 80 years ago. How do you know when your children have taken adult responsibility? And I think it's this, and you might agree with me or you might not. One day, you go into the room and it's tidy. Oh, well, you've done very well. One day, they dry the dishes and put them away. Oh, that's amazing. One day, they cut the grass without being told. One day, they wash the car without being told. Suddenly, they have taken responsibility and want to help their parents instead of sitting around watching mum or dad slaving away. Would you agree with me at the back, men? Yes. And that's true. These guys, young men at the back, are taking responsibility. But I would think 10 years ago, you'd be through there or sitting playing or whatever. But you've taken responsibility. And this is what was happening to Joseph. He had become aware that he had imposed responsibility, but he took it. Not only did he take it, but God's blessing was on him, and he became the leader, the butler of the house, if you like. He was the boss next to Potiphar, but the wife fancied him. Come and sleep with me. No, can't do that. My master trusts me and I will not let him down. And she keeps pestering him. And eventually he says, no, I will not. I will not let my master down, nor will I sin before God. Suddenly there was this spirituality in him. He began to realize that God was there, looking after, protecting, guarding and keeping. And he was not going to let God down. A crash course in taking responsibility. It was a difficult course. Not only was he accused, because the wife was enraged, he turned down her advances, and when Potiphar came back, look, I've got his tunic. I cried out when he tried to rape me, and Potiphar is enraged. The head of the household of his servants betrayed him like that, and he sends him to prison. And Joseph is in prison. We read again that God's favor was on him, and he is what you would call the pass man. The pass man has certain privileges, and he's looking after that section of the prison. He's doing very well, but he is here, there, unjustly accused, but serving the other prisoners in prison. The baker and the cupbearer come into prison. Something happened in the household, the royal household of Pharaoh. They were accused. They were both sent to prison. And one night they have dreams. And the cupbearer says, "I had an amazing dream last night. While you're with me, while you're serving the meal, let me tell you about this. I saw the hand grasping the bunch of grapes and squeezing them into the cup." Joseph says, "You know what that means? Three bunches of grapes squeezed. In 3 days, you'll be back with Pharaoh. In 3 days, you'll be released." The baker's amazed. Goodness me. And that's what happened. But the baker says, "Well, I saw I was carrying a board of bread and the birds of the air came and took it." What does that mean? Hoping it was going to be something positive. Joseph says, "In 3 days, you'll be taken and executed." As the cupbearer goes out of the prison, Joseph says, "Don't forget me. Tell Pharaoh that I've been wrongly accused. Don't forget me." But he does. 2 years pass, and Pharaoh has a dream. And that dream, of course, is the seven lean cattle and the seven fat cattle, the seven small ears of corn and the seven fat ears of corn, and how one absorbs the other or eats the other. And he's perplexed. His astrologers, his wise men can do nothing about it. And suddenly the cupbearer says, "Oh, I remember there was a Hebrew in the prison. He can answer dreams. He interpreted the dreams. You remember the baker? You executed him. I was returned to your presence." And Pharaoh says, "Get him out of prison. Bring him here." Joseph, shaved, cleaned up, new clothes, stands in front of Pharaoh. Was he somebody who was pleading for a pardon? For a pardon for the sin or the crime he did not commit? Was he somebody who was overawed by the presence of Pharaoh? Was he looking for some sort of appeal, some sort of situation where Pharaoh would say, there, it's all right? He stood in front of Pharaoh with an authority. He wasn't cowed and servile. He was there with an authority. And Pharaoh said, "I believe you can answer dreams." And he answers in the negative. "No, I can't." But God can. "I can't, but God can. Your pagan gods will not be able to do it, but my God will." And when Pharaoh relates all these things to him, he says, 7 years of famine, 7 years of goodness, and 7 years of famine. You've got 7 years to prepare for the famine. Build storehouses. Get somebody responsible. Build it up and be able to sustain the nation while they're going through the famine. He had an authority before Pharaoh, given by God. God was with him through all the problems. God was preparing him for this moment. And at that moment, Pharaoh says, "You are the man. I want you to do the job. You are the Chancellor of the Exchequer. You will be the one who will organize this nation to survive in the famine." You know the story probably better than me. But the story goes on, of course, that the famine hits the land and the 10 brothers come. The youngest, Benjamin, is still at home. 10 brothers come. "Mighty Pharaoh, here is your representative. This guy dressed as an Egyptian. This guy speaking as an Egyptian. This guy with the authority of the Chancellor of the Exchequer. Yes, what do you want?" "We want food." And he recognizes them. He knows who they are, but he treats them harshly. He says, "You're spies." No, "You're spies." And he accuses them. They are overawed, but they get the grain. They get the grain and the money in it, they go back home. And they can't understand it. "Jacob, Dad, look, we've got all the grain, but they returned the money. Isn't that not amazing?" Some months pass. They're starving again and again. They've got to go in. And again, they're accused. And the silver cup is put in the sack when they come back. And we are told that they all have to go back. The riders come. Stop. Examine what you're doing. There is a cup. We've all got to go back and expect enslavement or whatever. And the story, to cut it short, the story goes that the brothers, I cannot understand this. They are utterly perplexed. But Pharaoh ultimately says, or Joseph ultimately says, look, here's a meal for you, a banquet for you. Eat this banquet, enjoy it. And he asked the officials to go, guards, officials, go. And he then says to them, I am Joseph. That moment of amazing drama, I am Joseph. And of course they shrink back in horror. What's this going to be, a show trial? Mass executions, what's going to happen? But Joseph says, listen, it's okay. You meant it for harm, God meant it for good. You meant it for harm, God meant it for good. That was 13 years from being put in that well to standing, speaking to his brothers. 13 years of preparation for that moment of drama. I'm fine, thanks, John. It's okay. I've just got a slight cold. Anyway, that moment of drama, you meant it for harm, God meant it for good. Go and get Dad, bring them all back. You'll live in the land of Goshen and the Nile Delta. That's where you're going. God used that process to bring about Israel, the children of Israel, into Egypt. What is God saying in all this? I believe God has said to me, God is not limited by your logic or my logic, what you think is right or what I think is right. God can do what he pleases. He is a sovereign God. He can please, he can work through the awkward neighbor, the disgruntled boss, the friend who has hurt you. God is in it. And if we love God and if we've wrestled with God and found our identity in him, then we know that he is in charge of our destiny. God will move despite our logic, despite those things that we think, this can't be right, this can't be of God. God will use anything and everything to fulfill his purpose in you. And sometimes we think, this can't be right, why am I suffering? God is perhaps training you. The next thing is, what do you perceive as chaos? What do you perceive as hurt in the situation? God is using that to prepare you. There is purpose in difficulty. There is purpose in crisis. And God will use you in that process to achieve his ends. Can we appropriate that to ourselves? Can we wrestle with God to find our new identity? Can we stand before Pharaoh and say, I know who my Redeemer lives. I am strong enough to have his authority in dealing with this situation. Amen.